worried about Ray, and so we should be. He's here in the studio, my very special guest this morning. Ray, thank you so much for coming in. A very familiar voice, maybe not such a familiar face to our listeners, but you've been broadcasting in this area and around everywhere for a very long time, haven't you?
30 plus years and getting paid for it. Before that, I have got a recording of me on the radio from August the something or other 1971. So a while.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you had a very, very early interest in radio. This is what you wanted to do and you did it.
Yeah, there were three things that I wanted to do, Mike. One, because I grew up in the wilds of Essex, in the rural part of Essex, really, really rural part of Essex. Dad worked on the farm, so I wanted to work on the farm. And then realised that wasn't going to make me rich. Not that any job that I've done has made me rich.
But not radio. No.
The other thing I wanted to do was work on the radio. And the third thing was turn the girls round in the tubs on the waltzer at the fair. I would still love to have done that.
You still can.
Yeah, but at the age of 60, you think those tubs are pretty heavy. So yeah, that's what I wanted to do. Radio was one of the things that I always wanted to do. And I took a tortuous route to get to it, the long way round, as I do with many of my escapades. But, you know, I've had some very, very happy years doing it, and hopefully a few more to come in the future.
So how did it start? What did you do first? Did you take the route that I took, which was a hospital radio at first?
Radio Chelmsford didn't really want me. I went over once, and this was at the age of about 15, 16, and I lived in Burnham. I still do live in Burnham. I grew up in Burnham. And getting from Burnham to Chelmsford when you couldn't drive still isn't easy, no. But it was impossible in the early 70s. So I didn't take that route. I remember at school, the headmaster invited us all into his office just before we left and said, "And what are you going to do for a living?" And I said, "I'd like to work on the radio." And he laughed and said, "Oh, I think you ought to put that out of your mind." He was probably right, to be honest. But at that time, I had a really broad, proper, rural Essex accent. So, you know, my name wasn't Ray Clark. It was Ray Clark.
I can understand
perhaps him laughing a little. But no, I dabbled in land-based pirates as youngsters did in the 70s because there was no way to get on the radio. Although I thought I might have hit on success in that my first job when I left school was with the BBC. But it was in programme accounts, and I paid people. They said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I'd like to go on the radio." And they said, "Yeah, so does everybody else. Go into accounts." So I did that for a couple of years. My first proper radio station gig was on Caroline in the 80s. But as I say, I dabbled all the way through the 70s. I'd done mobile discos. I'd convinced together with this is unbelievable story this but one of my schoolmates was an estate agent who worked in an estate agency. He's now vicar, the error.
I see the route.
And he was in the estate agents one day, and this building representative came in from a firm called Broseley, who I think were national at the time, and they said, "Oh, we're going to start this new, they don't call them estates, development, we'd like you to handle the sales." And they got talking about radio. And at that time, Essex Radio, as was, and Radio Warwell in Suffolk were new kids on the block. And Martin, the guy in the estate agent, said, "Oh, me and my mate, we make radio commercials." Because he was in a band and he was mad keen on radio. We'd never made a radio commercial in our life. But we managed to... I got one of those little Casio keyboards and came up with a jingle. And... we went to this guy from Broseley and said, "Yeah, we can do that, no trouble at all." And I suppose my first paid-for radio performance was in the late 70s, listening to myself, or early 80s, listening to myself on the radio twice every hour, 24 hours a day for about 3 weeks, and we had this commercial going out.
Were you that sort of child like me, probably in the late 60s, had a radio? This is before we had earpieces, where you actually took a small transistor radio to bed and listened to the radio under the pillow in case mum and dad heard you.
No, I did that. And it was with mum and dad's blessing to a point, you know, turn that off now, go to bed. Yeah. So I never had to hide the things under the bedclothes. But, yeah, and it's hard if you speak to youngsters now, they'll think, you know, what life were you living there?
Yeah.
You know, where was your MP3 player? Where was your computer?
Yeah, where was
your
YouTube?
Phone?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's hard to imagine now, 30, 40 years later, which in our minds is just a few months later, that technology has changed so much. And you know, jumping ahead to talk about Radio Caroline, where is this thing that people could have gone to prison for sitting on a rusty ship playing a Bruce Springsteen song?
Absolutely.
And now you can have a radio station in your back pocket. It's just bonkers, isn't it?
I know, and it's a great advancement. But at the same time, I think we valued music more then than perhaps people do today. I don't know, I could be completely wrong, but I just felt we were all, you know, you tuned to the Sunday Top 40 and taped it, and nobody must talk or have a television on, or you take Top of the Pops in those days. It was music was very, very precious to it.
I think you're right, Mike, and I think it is an age thing, because we were around when you didn't have music instantly available. And I think that's the case with, as you get older, you look at a lot of things, and everything is available and attainable. You might not be able to pay for it, but you can still get it.
Yeah.
You know, you worry about paying for it later.
Yes, absolutely.
But things like music, you'd hear a song on the radio and you'd, wow, what was that song? So there's no way of using Spotify or whatever to find out what it was called. You had to wait until you heard it again.
Again, exactly.
And then you go to your record shop and you'd say, I want this song. And the guy, invariably, he'd be about 60 or 70, perhaps as old as 80. Who knows? Hey, well, I've never heard of that. Can you order it for me? Yes. Yeah, it'll be a couple of weeks.
Well, absolutely.
So you had to wait 2 weeks for it. And then you'd get it, and you'd smell the thing, and you'd hold it so
and it
tactile.
Was more precious.
Yeah, and you'd take it home. You couldn't wait to put it on that record player. Now you hear a song, and you think, oh, that's good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 99 pence. Ding! Yeah. Yeah, download. I'll have it.
Exactly. And how many hours did you spend reading record sleeves, etc.? Yeah. So you knew far more about the artist thing. I'd spend hours, you know, pouring through Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Pink Floyd album covers. A great pleasure. And those days are gone, I think, because people don't really read CD covers, do they?
The thing that I loved, I used to go down to Devon. My gran lived in Cornwall, on the Cornwall-Devonshire border. We used to go down there each year, and we'd go into Plymouth. And Plymouth, I mean, bear in mind I was coming from Burnham, and there was nowhere in Essex, I don't think, that was a big town. Certainly no cities. I mean, we've only now got a city down the road. But in the 60s, you go to Plymouth, and there was the Plymouth Market, and in there were three second-hand record stores. And to go through those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of records that were for sale for, as was, 2 shillings as second-hand records, and to suddenly find something that you heard it, yes, you know, it sounds laughable, but you could find a record in a second-hand record store. I've been after that for ages, and now, you know, back to what I just said, just on computer, ting,
absolutely. Go. We come from maybe a different era where when we were young men, shall we say, there were only really two alternatives on the radio. It was either the home service or the light service, and then something wonderful happened, and we'll come on to that in just 1980-81. This would have been about, this is when, on the days of Breeze AM. You were doing overnights, so I was doing occasional everything, so that's where we first got together. But let's go back to the very beginning of your serious radio career, because, as I just mentioned, in the early 60s, the home service, the light service, that was all that was around. It was illegal to play anything else, and along came a wonderful thing called pirate radio, which the government really hated at the time. But what's happened since? Tell me, Ray, how did you first get involved with Caroline?
I was smitten from... I seem to remember that I heard it over that first weekend. One of my memories is of looking at the back page of the Daily Mirror on Easter Monday, because you had the papers then, and perhaps it was the Tuesday, I can't remember. There might not have been papers on bank holiday. And I was 9, and I can distinctly remember saying to my mum, look, there's a picture of that radio station that we've heard. So I'd heard it over the weekend that it started, Easter 1964. But if you look back on those newspaper reports, so had millions of others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what were we doing? Tuning around? Because it didn't have any advanced publicity. It was just suddenly there. And there was something that was completely different to the BBC. The music, if you listen to the recordings of Caroline when it first started now, it was so laid back, it was almost asleep. And there were two or three announcers, and all they were doing was saying, well, here's another record. And that was Ray Conniff. And here's Cilla Black. And that was Cilla Black. And here are the Beatles. It was hardly exciting.
Yeah.
But it was of the time. And if you listen to that and realise that gained a huge audience, it just goes to point to how bad and boring the BBC must have been in 1964.
And it must have been. And it was obviously an avenue that needed to be approached. So how did you personally... obviously not in 1964, but a little bit later than that.
Well, it took a long time. As a kid, I was loyal to the Pirates. I was loyal to Caroline. And I can remember even at school, we'd have these big arguments. Are you a Radio London listener or a Radio Caroline listener?
Yeah.
And we'd have this big debate. And I was heartbroken when they were closed down in 1967. But Caroline said, yeah, we're going to continue. And they did for a while till the money ran out. And even then, I didn't tune to Radio 1. There was a Dutch pirate station called Radio Veronica.
Yeah, I remember it well.
And myself and many of my friends of the age listened, because although they were talking in Dutch, you could hear the songs because the songs were British, and in many cases, songs that weren't being played on Radio 1. And it had the added bonus of now, all these years later, I can count up to 100 in Dutch. But and I've got friends in Holland as well. So it was all part of this thing. Then back in the 70s, Caroline came along again. As with everything in my career, it's not that straightforward. In the mid to late 70s, I was in Holland with some friends of mine that I'd met at a radio conference. This was a get-together of pirate radio fans and disc jockeys. And I'd got to know a couple of really good friends of mine, Hans and Louise, brother and sister. And they said, oh, come over to Holland. So this is about 1977, 78. I went over there and realised, not at the time, until I was there, that the boyfriend of Louise was the engineer on Caroline. And I thought, wow.
You're there.
So you know, I got to know the guy, good guy. And, you know, the offer was there. Go out to Caroline. I'd been out on one or two sort of visitor trips, you know, 3 hours in a little boat throwing up and just to see...
This is where I'd have gone wrong, you see. I'd have been throwing up my radio career. Up,
so you'd have been okay, Mike. Anyway, the offer was there, come out to Caroline, and then the ship sank.
Ah, yeah, that'll do it. Yes, I remember it well, yeah.
So then, you know, the interest was still there, but it was 1986. I'd been out again. And I just thought, this is silly. If I don't go out, then I got to know one or two of the guys there. And they said, well, why don't you come out? And I thought, you know, I might just. So I went out just for six, seven weeks I was there. And it was an amazing experience, a real adventure. But again, I had never thought of radio as a career. It was a dream. Mm-hmm. But I thought, yeah, it's not for me. You know, I'm not going to get this gig. And I went out there 6 or 7 weeks, loved it. They seemed quite happy with me, invited me back. But I had a job where I had to earn money, so to pay the mortgage. So I said, well, I'll come back another day. And I was due to be back there again in November 87 and should have been on board when the 300-foot-high mast came tumbling down.
Okay.
So again, that was a really close escape. But I went away and drove coaches for a year after that. And then I was in Bournemouth with some people on holiday. And there on the radio was Kevin Turner, one of my colleagues from Caroline, and a good friend of mine. And I just phoned him up and said, fancy meeting up for a drink? And in a chance remark, he just said, you really ought to try and apply for a radio station job. You know, you really weren't that bad. So whereas before going to Caroline, I'd applied for half a dozen jobs or more. And if I got an answer at all, it was go and get experience.
Yeah.
I just sort of sent four tapes out. I'd been on Caroline. I was offered four jobs. You know, whether it was through ability, whether they liked what they heard, or just thought, if this guy's crazy enough to sit on a ship out there that, you know, that's not seaworthy without a marine crew, you know, he's good enough for us.
You've written a book entitled The Boat That Rocked, The Truth Behind The Boat That Rocked. First, well, let's talk about the film, of course, because that gave a huge insight into the world of pirate radio. Very, very briefly, Ray, did I get it right?
No.
Nowhere near it?
No, nowhere near. The only thing, and I've spoken with friends and colleagues that were on the ships since, the only thing that they did get right, and I think that was by default, was the camaraderie, the friendship. There on this ship, and it was really the case with Caroline, certainly when I was there, there were about 15 people from completely different backgrounds. Completely different. I mean, I'd grown up in a tide cottage on a farm, then
yeah,
mum and dad
yeah.
eventually were lucky enough to get a council house. One of my best mates was a guy that had gone to Dulwich College, and that had cost his mum and dad an arm and a leg, had a completely different accent to mine. And in fact, we spoke with him, worked with him, Peter Phillips.
Peter Phillips, of course, yes.
And completely different background to mine. We were good mates. We still are good mates all these years later. There was a guy that worked on a pig farm. There was a guy that drove a forklift truck in a bath cube factory. I mean, we'd got all these completely diverse backgrounds, but we were all literally in the same boat. And our survival, very survival, depended on getting on with each other. So that bit in the film was spot on. As for the rest of it, nah.
Are you telling me there weren't boatloads of gorgeous young ladies arriving
in the
club?
I was out there, as I say, for 7 weeks in the stint that I did. I saw one young lady who on the laser ship, and she was very nice. And I've since found out that she was American. Well, I knew she was American. She's gone back to America. She was working on the laser ship, Laser 558, or Laser Hot Hits, as the radio station was then. And she's now, and I love this word, I can never get it right, a phlebotomist.
A phlebotomist.
Yeah. So she's the blood nurse in downtown somewhere in America.
So it wasn't all wonderful then. I'm assuming everybody's seasick occasionally. The food was terrible.
Food was okay. I remember we had a guy out there called Gary who went out as the chef. And he was on our shift. And he tried, and he was coming up with quite good meals, edible meals at least. And those that had a talent in any way, engineering or cooking, you know, you did a little bit. And in the stores, because we got a lot of stores from Spain and originally when the ship was fitted out, and from Holland. And in the stores were these catering tins of what looked like apple chunks. Now, I know where the mistake came from. They were great big catering tins with pictures of apples around. So you would have thought they were apple chunks. So he made two pies, huge, great big pies, done with the pastry, opened up the tin, and the Dutch love apple mousse, which is like our apple sauce, but they'll eat bowlfuls of it, whereas we have a little dab with a piece of pork. They'll have bowls and bowls full of this apple mousse. Of course, he tipped all the stuff into the pastry, and it wasn't chunks of apple, it was apple mousse, so it spread all over the cooker, all over. So we had this soggy pastry and stuff, gunk, basically. So not all the meals were cuisine, but high cuisine, but we survived.
I'm sure you did. Right, we'll come back in a moment. Let's play a tune from that time. And thing at the moment, I was saying that carnage will happen, I'm sure. It always does. As soon as I say there's no travel, then it goes berserk. That's the plight of radio. Talking of radio, that is what we're talking this morning. My guest this morning is, this afternoon is my good old friend. He's not old, he's young, he's very young. Ray Clark, who's been in radio, since time began, really, and a fantastic journey. So what promoted you to write the book? Why did you write the book? Because you're not an author.
No, that shows. You've noticed. We've all got a mastermind topic. You know, some people might be able to list the kings and queens of England. I haven't got the faintest idea. I can do Elizabeth II, but I'm not quite sure who went before her. Others can talk endlessly. This is my mastermind topic.
Right.
If I had to sit in that black chair, Mike, this is the topic that I would be able to answer questions about. Pirate radio and Radio Caroline. Don't ask me why. I have other interests. I do have a life, but I'm particularly fascinated by the history of this radio station. And the story goes back almost a couple of years ago. Every year in Holland, back to Holland again, there's a group of people that get together and have a radio day in Amsterdam. And the idea, yep, actually, it's an excuse for a good drink with old friends. So you go over to Amsterdam. They have a sort of conference during the afternoon showing old films, interviewing people much like this, you know, tell us what it was like in the old days. And then everybody meets up, has a lovely Chinese meal, and we spend the evening in the bar and sort of stagger back to our hotel rooms about 1 o'clock. Perhaps a little earlier than that now because we're all getting a bit older. But I'd been to the event in 2012. It was November 2012. And I had a good weekend of meeting up with people and was really back into this pirate radio thing again and thought, oh, yeah, it's quite interesting. There were special days, you know. Perhaps you shouldn't forget it all this quickly. Went to Lakeside a couple of days later. There's a friend of mine that I used to work on the radio with, Peter Stewart, used to be head of news at Essex FM as was.
I know him well.
And we meet up once, twice a year. He was working for the BBC in Guildford. I was working for BBC Essex. So we meet in the middle, Lakeside. Invariably, I got there earlier than him. And if you're a guy and you go to a shopping mall, what do you do to kill time? You go to Dixon's, first of all, and have a look at all the gadgets.
Yes.
Then you go into the Apple shop and have a look at the gadgets. And then after that, it's Waterstones. So I was walking around the book shelves, and I just thought, oh, what is there for me here? Caroline, no chance. Radio, the scripts of the Archers, television. I thought, nobody's written a book about Caroline proper. There had been books about pirate radio, but none about the history of Caroline. And whilst I wouldn't profess to know everything, because nobody will ever know everything that happened
connected to
Caroline, but I had interviewed about 40, 50, 60 of the major players over the years. mainly for radio, but I'd got all of those interviews and I'd used very little of them. And I was in a position where I'd got on well with a lot of people that were involved and still knew a lot of people, so I could ask questions. And I thought, you know, perhaps it's the 50th anniversary of Caroline next year, a couple of years or whatever. I really ought to do that. So I went home, looked in the dust jackets of a few books that I'd got, and just sent an email off to half a dozen publishers. I've got this idea. Are you interested? And not really expecting any response, because you hear this story, publishers never get back to people. Mm-hmm. I had 4 return emails. Good idea, but not for us. Keep trying. Try somebody else. And I thought, well, this is quite positive. So I won the 5th one. I got an email reply the next day from a company in Suffolk. They were so excited. I thought, oh, yeah, this is it. You know, asking loads and loads and loads and loads of questions. I thought, got it made. Never heard from them again. And then the 6th one, I thought, well, History Press. I saw the History Press. It's history. So I, they did stories about all sorts of things. They publish a wealth of books. So I just emailed them. Are you interested? Yes, we are. And they had to have high-level meetings as to whether they were going to go with this book or not. They came back and said, yeah, we'll publish that book. So, wow, now I've got to put my money where my mouth is. You know, I've got to write the thing. So I started doing that in January 2013. I had to get it to them about this time last year, September 2013, ready for publication in February this year. It came out in March this year, just 2 or 3 weeks before Caroline's 50th anniversary. And publishing is a bit like radio. You don't really know unless you ask. And I haven't asked, but by all accounts, it seems to be going quite well. But they haven't, you know, one, I'm not driving around in a Rolls Royce. 2, I haven't had checks through the door, right. Perhaps one day. 3, I'm not going to get rich out of it, which isn't the intention. But I have written the book. I've got a kick out of writing the book. And a lot of people have said nice things about it.
Exactly. I read the reviews on Amazon today. So I read 2 things about Amazon today. The other one was a big article by the comedian David Mitchell, who made a big speech very recently about Amazon and criticising Amazon. And then it spoiled it all at the end, because it said his book is now available on Amazon. He said, well, why wouldn't I put my book on the biggest selling marketplace in the world? But so was it an enjoyable experience for you? Or was it, did it become a task?
No, because I'm that sad man that would answer questions on Mastermind. I know the story. I know how it goes. You know, there's so many variations of the story, but I know the basis of it. And as I say, I'd got many of the people who were involved at the time. And I make a point of saying, as I did just now, nobody knows the full story. But I have been speaking to a lot of people that were there at certain times. Now, you might get 2 people that are in the same situation at the same time and both look at it in a different aspect. That's more than likely. But we're not a million miles away from the truth. There's an awful lot more that could come out, but probably never will. And sadly, you know, some of the players either no longer around now, or in the case of Ronan O'Reilly, the guy that started it, sadly not at all well. So you can't sit down and interview him, though I have done in the past. Jocelyn Stevens was another man who was in at the start, who became, I think, head of British Heritage or whatever. He's sadly not well enough to speak now. So, you know, we missed the boat with him. But I was lucky enough to have access to a number of interviews that had been done in the 70s with people that are no longer alive. Caroline disc jockey from the 60s, an Australian guy called Colin Nicol, had done those interviews. And he said, well, I'm never going to publish them. Use them.
Right.
So I was able to have access to those. And they really did give an insight into the very early days of pirate radio in the UK.
And there were some very big names in radio who worked in pirate radio in those days, wasn't there? It was the start of Tony Blackburn's career and many more.
Emperor Roscoe.
I remember going to see the Simon D show on television.
Really?
At Lime Grove Studios, which are no longer there, in 1967. And that night, the band was The Move, and they played... Get the Fire Brigade.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it's just huge. I mean, nobody in this day and age is as big as that. That, you know, they were just huge.
Absolutely. And at random, give various couples tickets that take them right to the front. I just think that's just a really cool thing to do. Brilliant.
I was, while we were talking Springsteen, I just did a tour of YouTube the other, well, not everything on YouTube, but just went through YouTube. And to see him, I've never been lucky enough to go to one of his concerts, but just going back and doing 60s stuff again.
Yeah.
And I saw an interview once where he said that Eric Burdon and the Animals were the greatest band and they were influential. Eric Burdon was influential in him becoming a rock star. But he would do stuff like, we've got to get out of this place, and I Fought the Law, Buddy Holly, Bobby Fuller Four song. And it's just good to watch it. And the guy obviously enjoys doing that, and so do the crowd as well. Just search it out on YouTube.
Absolutely. You were the voice of BBC Essex Breakfast for 10 years.
Not quite, seven.
Seven years. How was that for you? Did you love the experience?
Yeah, I was doing all speech. I'd never set out when I worked on the radio to beat up politicians, and I don't like beating up anybody unless they deserve it, verbally. I would run a mile if it got physical. Yeah, it was a challenge. They liked what I did. I'd done music presentation, and they said, well, come and talk on the BBC. And I thought, yes, I'll do that. And I loved my time there. I was lucky. I won a number of awards, so people seemed to like what I was doing. I had a good audience as well. And, you know, in BBC, whether they'd admit it or not, you've got to have a good audience. Otherwise, you know, it might be suggested you do a different programme or perhaps a different job. Perhaps you could argue in the past it hasn't been quite as competitive as commercial radio, but, you know, give it time. It's getting that way. So I did that, and I loved it. But I'd got to the point where I'd been doing that for 7 years, and I've got a short patience. I don't get angry, but I get bored easily.
Right, okay.
And I just thought, yeah, I want to do something different. And a bit daft, really, because I could have stayed doing the breakfast programme and stayed working. But I'd got to 60 and thought, well, I've been lucky enough to work all the way through my career, not all the time on the radio, but, you know, because of our generation, again, we were in a better position to get a job. It's perhaps not been as easy in recent years. And I thought, I just fancy a break. I fancy a bit of a rest. My wife is a school teacher. She'd been teaching all her working career, and she decided she was going to retire. So the deal is that I've had 3 months off so far, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. But I'm not going to say no. If the phone rings, I might well go back. I haven't quite got to the point where I desperately need to go back to do something, but I'm just beginning to think of things that I could do.
You haven't picked up a golf club or a fishing rod
no,
yet?
No, no, no. Both of those bore me. I mean, one, my eyesight's not good enough for golf, so I quite like the idea of walking around a golf link.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't be any good at putting that little ball in a hole. I mean, I'm quite good at the one with the windmill at Yarmouth.
Okay,
that's quite good. And fishing, no, it's never really done it for me. In Crixie, just up from Burnham yesterday, I was out on my bike, and there was a guy in his deck chair, right, it was low tide, and he was right down on the foreshore, and I thought, you do look silly there. But he was content, he was quite happy, just sitting there with his fishing rod, whether he caught anything or not, I don't know.
We've gone from a country where there was no radio choice, really, apart from two or three stations, into the 60s when we had the pirate radio, and then and Luxembourg, and then the start of the BBC, the four big stations. And we've gone off from that, and we've gone to then commercial radio during the 70s and 80s, that's all still with us. And now the birth in the last 10 years of really of community stations like this, small stations which have grown up. We've almost mimicked America, whereas the joy in America was in the 70s. If you wanted to hear a Beatles song, there was a Beatles station or an Elvis station. You could hear what you want. We're nearly there with that. How healthy do you think British radio is at the moment?
I never thought as a radio fan that I would ever say there's too much choice, but it's almost like, it's back to what I was talking about availability. You're spoilt for choice. There is just so much. But sadly, in many cases, it's all the same. You know, even BBC National Radio, now you used to have the top presenters. Now you get stand-up comedians. And sorry, they're not radio presenters. That might sound a bit precious, but they're not. They might be the funniest people in the world on stage, and you laugh out loud. But as a radio presenter, that's a more intimate thing. And they're not so good at doing that. Commercial radio, still pulling in the listeners. But you just get the feeling that even without the presenter, it would still pull in the listeners because people want to listen to the music. I think community station has got a quite healthy future. But I think, I mean, some stations, like Phoenix, do it better than others. And I could name those that, you know, you listen to and you think, no, thank you.
Yeah.
But I still think that even the best community stations need a bit more help. And that's something that the Radio Authority could, or Ofcom now, could perhaps help with, because the availability of money is so limited Because a station like Phoenix can't sell as many commercials as another commercial station in Essex because of the way that the rules and the structure stand. And I think those rules should be relaxed a little bit. And why shouldn't you be able to go out and sell more commercials, which would bring in more money, which would mean that the station could be better? You could promote it in a bigger way. You could go out
and
go to the people more. You know, it's very much hand-to-mouth and relies on volunteers, and many of those volunteers are very good. But if you've got a bit of money, you know, then you could say, well, actually, thank you for coming over. We appreciate that. It's a bit of petrol money, you know. Yeah. You're not doing a whole day's work for nothing.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a danger that, you know, this is just the view of Chairman Ray, but nationally, I like the idea of this, you know, volunteer, but I don't like the idea of people saying, well, I'm getting paid actually 40, 50, 60,000, and what we ought to do is volunteer.
Yeah,
you know, that's not happening in community radio.
Absolutely.
But it is happening in commercial radio. You want to be on the radio? Work for nothing, absolutely, says the chairman of the group.
Okay. I do worry a little bit. I was just from a conversation I had with my own daughter yesterday. She's 14. I said, what radio stations are you listening to and your friends are listening to? None of them. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Well, we get away all from YouTube and it's down and we don't know. We're not really, no, don't risk.
A talk 10 years ago now to primary school children at Langdon Hills, just beyond Billericay, halfway between Billericay and Basildon. And I stood there with all of these youngsters from the whole primary school, the juniors, and I said, who's got a mobile phone? Yeah, we've got a mobile phone. Yeah. Who's got an MP3 player? Who's got a radio? There weren't many. And that's scary. And a lot of my radio listening is done online now. And that's not altogether a bad thing because it's still the radio. But it's youngsters that radio have got to go out on a track because, you know, in 20 years' time, when we're not sitting here doing this stuff, who's going to come along and do it? Or more to the point, who's going to be listening to it? And is it going to be worth doing?
I picked up on Sunday a huge big box. It says Echo Radiogram on the bottom. It was built in 1946. It says Hilversum, Luxembourg. It's just beautiful. A big old valve set. And that to me was a proper radio set. We obviously can't carry it around, etc. Ray, I know that we're going to see you again on the radio. And let's just go back to the book again. Are you going to do another one? I don't know.
People have been saying, you know, what else? I don't know anything else. One of my former colleagues at Essex Radio, where we both worked for a long, long time ago, got in touch and said, love the book. Are you going to do one about Essex Radio? And I just wrote back, no, I don't do Scandal. So, it's Radio Caroline, the true story of the boat that rocked. And yeah, see where it takes me. It's selling quite nicely. And available now, but do I know enough about other subjects to write about? I mean, you know, wealth of stories I could come up with about the life and times of a radio presenter over 40 years, but do you really want to read that? I'm not sure. So I don't know. I think I'm more likely to appear on a radio station than I am to write another book.
And I'm sure you'd be very welcome. Just about the book, how can we buy it apart from Amazon? Is it for sale?
I spoke to the guy. I was quite really chuffed. I went into Chelmsford, into Waterstones the other day, and was talking to the guy there. And he said, we've sold 62 copies of your book. And I thought, well, that's good. And I don't know how many I was expecting to sell, but I thought, well, 62 in each branch.
Cracked that, you see. Now, this is where I struggled, because I bought out two local history films, one on Hornchurch, one on Upminster. I couldn't get it, because I was an individual, I couldn't get them into the big shops.
Well, that's the thing, you see, through the publisher. I mean, you know, I could make a pile of money had I printed it and then sold it personally. But, you know, I don't get much from £1.50 a book, I think I get.
Yeah.
But by having a publisher, then they can get it into the big chains. They can. I don't know. I'm not a bookseller. I'm not a businessman.
And somehow my film is on Amazon. And I haven't agreed that. And they're selling it for £1 more than I was selling it for. It's a very, very strange setup. Ray, we'll look forward to you coming back on radio in Essex somewhere in some form. I'm sure you will. And I'm not going to say enjoy your retirement, because I know you're not going to.
I wanted a rest. I'd got to the point where I'd been doing same thing day in, day out. You need to keep fresh in radio. And I was always conscious of that. And the one thing I would hate to do is bore people. And I was beginning to bore myself. So I thought, no, have a rest here. Just have a rest. I'd run out of witty things to say. But now I've got to stop more of witty things to say, I hope. But I think, yeah, I've always said in radio, I've got all the answers, but you've got to be a bit like a carpenter with, you know, the old-fashioned wood planes. I don't know if they still use them, probably through a big machine now made in Japan. But at school, I did woodwork. I wasn't very good at it, but the teacher used to love these wood planes, and you could set them to take off a slither of wood every time. And I think as a presenter, you've got to do that. You've got to take off a slither of your style of presentation every day. You've got to be slightly different every day. You can't just take it for granted, because you're in a very, very special position where people invite you into their lives and you can speak to them. And the least you can do is to worry about getting it right and trying to do the best that you can, rather than just sitting there and saying, same old, I'm here for 3 hours, here's another song, bish, bash, bosh, I'm out. And you know, that doesn't sit well with me. And if I was listening to what I was saying and thinking, you know, you said that before, have a rest, then and that's my contribution to the audience.
And I take it you're not missing the 4 o'clock starts, 4:30 starts or something?
I was getting up at 3:30. 3:30 for 7 years. Now, I did Breakfast at Breeze for about 3 years as well. So I suppose 10 years of my life I've been getting up at 3:30.
Well, Ray Clark, enjoy your rest. I'm going to get your book, and I'm going to thoroughly read it, and I'm going to thoroughly enjoy it. And thank you very much for coming in and talking to us today.
Yeah,
and
don't
be a stranger. Come in. Your eyes lit up when you come into it, because you've never been here before.
I've never been to Phoenix. No,
and you said, I could see the man loves radio. But again, thank you very much indeed. And
thank
we'll talk
you
to you again.
Mike,
my pleasure. Let's have a very appropriate record.